Hi, this is Matthew Cherico, and you're about to listen to a podcast about my family history. The family history that I'm going to be discussing is going to be based off of two texts. One of the texts contains some published material, and I'll credit that towards the end. Actually, I'll be crediting that in text underneath the podcast playing module or whatever you want to call it. But the main text I'm going to be using is Big Green Binder of Family History, compiled by my great-grandmother, Ruth Gloria Bartholomew Warner. She initially started to do this, compiling a family history to join the Daughters of the American Revolution. So the Daughters of the American Revolution, it's a nonprofit that focuses on historic preservation and education. So my great-grandmother, ever involved in various organizations, decided in the 1980s, following her husband's death, that she was going to start devoting time to going to the New York Public Library, going through their records in order to verify that she had a relative in the American Revolution. She wound up finding out that we have a few in the American Revolution, at least one in the Civil War as well. So she passed away in 2010. She was 99, so if she was still alive now, she would be one of the oldest people on Earth. So I guess I should be thankful that she lived to 99. But I'd like to thank her, regardless, for compiling everything. She initially handed down this family history to my uncle Scott, who is a big history buff. And initially, when I went to college, I wanted to be a history teacher. And it was mainly because of him. And, well, I'm glad I didn't go that way. I'm still pretty interested in history, and I'm really glad that this assignment allows me to kind of cover ground that I might have done in, like, I don't know, some weird experimental history course. So I'm really glad I get to do this. So I have, as I said before, I'm basing this whole thing off of two texts. I already talked about the family history. The other text is an unpublished life writing piece, autobiography, journal, call it whatever you want, by my great-grandmother. It's titled In My Own Words. And I'll be reading, you know, a few chapters here and there from it throughout the podcast, you know, wherever it's relevant. My great-grandmother had a unique writing voice that I wasn't really aware of before. I can't remember what she sounded like. I just remember what she looked like. So it's great that I get to listen to her. And before I really begin digging into the family history, I also want to remark upon something that's very strange about this whole project. So it was spurred by me feeling like I didn't really have any connection to my family's roots in any way, but at the same time, I'm very weirdly spoiled because I have this family history thing right here in front of me, and I never really got past a few pages in it. So when I first moved to Pullman from Clifton, New Jersey, I left both that life writing piece by my great-grandmother and the family history binder behind because I have a small car. I drove across the United States. Didn't really have any utility to me. I was more worried about getting a couch, a bed, a table to eat off of. Well, a plate to put on a table to eat off of. Also. So I didn't bring it over initially. Then we had this discussion. In life, writing about, you know, tracing back our roots and all these things. And I couldn't really contribute anything because I just knew, oh, I come from these places. But I'm so far removed from them generationally that there's nothing there. At least I felt so at the time. So then when I was thinking about what to do for my life writing project, of course, I went, okay, I have a binder at home full of family history. So I should take advantage of that. So of course I call my parents, they send it. Turns out I called at the exact right time because I want to say about 2 weeks later, sometime in late October, we had a house fire at my house in New Jersey, and it was initially made out to sound like small to me. They like had to gut the house and everything. You know, my family's not able to get all of their stuff because the insurance company has to go through everything that was damaged. Of course, the fire started in the basement, and that is where I moved all of my belongings before I left, save for this binder and memoir, life writing piece, whatever you want to call it. I wound up actually, before I was leaving, giving both of those to my dad because my brother had borrowed the, in my own words, it's bound, I'll call it a book, the book by my great-grandmother, and spilling something on it a couple years ago. So, I mean, the cover's not ruined, but, you know, it's still not in mint condition like it was when I got it. So I figured, okay, I'll give it to my dad. He'll put it in his closet. It'll be safe. So wound up guessing correctly, and I'm glad I did. So, yeah, the whole thing is just a very weird situation overall, but I'm, as I said, also, I should have mentioned, everybody in my house got out fine. They even got the fish. They got my dog, the fish, all of the human people in my family got out fine. So everybody's okay. Nobody even had to get treated for, like, smoke damage or anything like that. Or smoke inhalation. I shouldn't say smoke damage. Smoke inhalation or anything like that. Not even that. Everybody got out fine. But they'll be out of the house for a few months. So this means I'll be spending Christmas, I guess, at a whatever place the insurance company finds for them to stay for the 6 months or whatever that they'll be out. And actually, they stayed with my grandmother and my grandfather initially after the fire. They didn't want to go to a hotel or anything like that. And my grandmother, when I called, remarked that our family had very bad luck with fires. This is because my great-grandmother, the one that compiled the family history and wrote this memoir, had a major house fire in January of 1993, and her house burned down. She burned about three quarters of her skin, spent 5 months in the hospital, and yeah, so it is apparent that our family doesn't do well with fires. I mean, obviously that's the worst case scenario. Well, close to worst case scenario. Thankfully she recovered and lived for another 17 years, so she made out okay, but her house completely burned down. Anyway, so I just thought that was a very strange thing that my grandma brought that up. She's completely unaware that I was working on this project too. So it's weird that this happened to happen when it did. So anyway, I will throughout this podcast be using both in my own words and the family history binder of documents and requests for documents in my attempt to at least kind of pick and choose some sort of things to look at in my family history. Because it when my great grandmother passed, it was not especially strange to me, but for some reason you don't really think about, you know, where people, at least me when I was younger, even when I was interested in history, I was interested in like general history, not where my family came from history, what part of the state my family initially moved to kind of history. So it was weird to me that my great-grandmother was buried in Sparrow Bush, which is in, I think, Sussex County, and is not that close to where she lived. So everything that I read kind of makes sense of that now. And yeah, so I'll be using readings from both the books, and then for at least the family history, I'll kind of either fill in some things that aren't really touched upon if I can, or I'll just kind of discuss them in general. Because there's a lot of things where there's the family history is not just completely written out like a book. A lot of it is documents, family trees, requests for documents, return letters responding to those requests for documents saying we can't really help you out that much. So it's a lot to dig through, but I think hopefully it'll be interesting and fun. So without further ado, let's get to it. I would like to start off with a reading from In My Own Words about genealogy. In My Own Words by Ruth Gloria Bartholomew Warner. This chapter is titled A Worthwhile Hobby. Not long ago, I read the obituary of a man who considered himself an amateur in many fields. Tennis, gardening, sailing, etc. Why an amateur if he was good in those hobbies? The Latin roots of the word amateur mean love. So I decided that perhaps I've been an amateur seamstress, baker, collector of carnival glass. But the word really fits when followed by the word genealogist. I love it. My mother at one time had two family Bibles, and they were a great help years ago when one of my sisters had to do a family tree for a school project. But I've followed that family tree even further back. My mother never knew that two of the men in our family had fought in the American Revolution, or that one of the two had received a letter from His Excellency, General George Washington, bestowing a badge of honor. My mother always said we had some, quote, Jersey Dutch, unquote, in us, and sure enough, the line from Holland arrived in New Amsterdam, now New York City, in 1625. Another ancestor, at the age of 56, enlisted in the Union forces during the Civil War. I will never know why he enlisted at such an age. Did he believe in the cause so strongly? Or did he want to keep his sons, who had young children, back at home? I've corresponded with many people concerning one line or another. The great-great-grandfather of one woman I corresponded with was the brother of my great-great-grandfather. 6 generations of my family are buried in the cemetery that was owned and started by her family. Genealogy is a never-ending chase. You catch one line, and then there's always another waiting to be caught. Sometimes soon, sometimes later, and often quite unexpectedly. Some family stories are provable, and some turn into legends that can't be proven. And when you talk or correspond with another amateur genealogist, you always end by saying or writing, "Happy hunting." Ruth Warner, February 10th, 1999. P.S. I like to think that my mother would enjoy what I'm doing with the information that she passed down.
So, I'd like to start off by talking about the Bartholomew branch of my family. There are 3 main branches contained within this book. Bartholomew is an overwhelming amount of this family history, but there also is the Ted Hills and the West family, West / Stearns family. So those are also contained within here, but most of the focus will be on the Bartholomew family. So for this, I did a little research online just to verify some things that I found in here, and actually, my first ancestor that came to America in the Bartholomew family came over extremely, extremely early in the history of the colony. So his name was William Bartholomew. He was born in either 1602 or 1603 in London, England. And he came over. It says here in my family history book that he was well educated, a merchant in England, and a householder in London. He married Anna Lord and arrived in America, or the New World, it says here, September 18th, 1634, in Boston, aboard the ship Griffin. Next year, he made free man, which is evidence he was a member of the church. May 6th, 1635, he represented the town of Ipswich, the general court in Boston. He was a member of that body several times and was honored by holding many offices and positions of trust during the ensuing 30 years. He removed to Charlestown, where he died January 18th, 1680. His wife Anna died January 29th, 1682. So, the first time I went through the family history book, somehow I didn't see that. So I even looked it up myself. And there is a website called packratpro.com/ships. And it just has all of these lists of people who were passengers on the first ships to come over. It says pilgrim passenger names, early 1600s, and the Bartholomews were listed on here. And then I went back through the family history book and verified it. Yeah, they came over on the ship Griffin in 1634, which is insanely early to think that any of my ancestors were here that early. Another mind-boggling thing that I kind of stumbled upon when doing research for this, there's a section prior to this list of family members titled Burford Church. And it is a church in Burford, Oxfordshire. My great-grandmother wrote about taking a visit to England and at some point wanting to see this church because apparently we have family buried there, and she wrote about it. She wrote, "In the summer of 1985, I was fortunate enough to visit England with one of my objectives, a visit to the church in Burford, Oxfordshire. Fortunately, I did not get there due to an impending rail strike. I thought I might be stranded there. Librarian at Digby Stewart College in Rockhampton, London, had found out the name of the church and the address. And after I returned home, I wrote to the church for information. The church secretary sent me a booklet relating the church history and other interesting facts." So, she doesn't have a full list of, you know, the church history and interesting facts, because it was a booklet, apparently, containing diagrams of the growth of the building of the church. But I'm eventually getting to the interesting part of it. So there is a chapel that was added to the church. It's called the Holy Trinity Chapel, and it is better known as the Bartholomew Aisle, and it cannot be used as a chapel because of the number of Bartholomews buried there. So apparently so many people in my family lived close by, lived in that area, and I guess died, that they filled up this whole chapel of a church to the point that it was unusable. And they just now refer to it as the Bartholomew Aisle, which is really fascinating. And then I decided to follow up my interest in this by looking up Burford Church and Bartholomew Aisle online, and actually stumbled upon a little British Isles genealogy page, and discovered that I actually have a family crest, which I had no idea that I had a family crest before. I initially thought that there were lions on this crest, but I, now looking closer, seeing that they are griffins, which is very funny that William Bartholomew came over on a ship called the Griffin to America, and his crest featured three griffins. The crest is an upside-down house shape, you know, how a child or artistically challenged adult like myself would draw a house, but upside down. So it features one griffin in the bottom corner and then one each in the two top corners with a red spiked line going through it. So I did some research as to what these symbols mean. Apparently a griffin symbolizes valor and death-defying bravery and vigilance. The red apparently stands for warrior or martyr, military strength, and magnanimity. And underneath this upside-down house filled with griffins is a little banner that has the name Bartholomew on it. And it is captioned on the website as the Bartholomew crest used by William Bartholomew of New England, and many other members of the family. There's also an image of the crest on the stone memorial in the church, in the chapel of the church. So that was something that was really fascinating, and I did not expect to find at all. I expected to, you know, just Google Bartholomew Isle, Beerford Church, and just verify that it existed. And it does, and more. So that was really interesting. So several generations down the line from William Bartholomew, the first immigrant of family to come to America, is Samuel Bartholomew. He is, I believe, five generations down from William, and yet five generations away from first ancestor in America was the ancestor that fought in the American Revolution, which is Samuel Bartholomew. He was born May 14th, 1745 in Branford, Connecticut. And he died December 17th, 1827 in Goshen, Connecticut. So most of the information that my great-grandmother, Ruth, found about Samuel Bartholomew is through the church records, the Goshen Church Records, Volume 1. And luckily for me, she didn't only get information through the Goshen Church Records. She also got a page from the Register of Revolutionary Soldiers and Patriots buried in Litchfield County, which lists Samuel Bartholomew here, as well as extracts from Goshen, Connecticut's Revolutionary Records, which lists Samuel Bartholomew as a surveyor of highways in 1776. So Samuel Bartholomew is my great-grandmother's great-great-great-grandfather. It is now after Samuel Bartholomew that I turn my attention to one of the other two families. That would be the West-Stearns family. My great-grandmother wrote in the book about them and how she started her research with them. She wrote, and I quote, "I started my research with the West family, led to interesting correspondence with several people, most of it with Sylvia Hendricks of Medway, Massachusetts. What an exciting day when I discovered that our great-great-grandfathers were brothers and had come to Forestburg, now Sparrowbush, the 1820s. Sylvia was born in the house at the foot of the hill where the road goes off the main road to Pine Hill Cemetery in Sparrowbush, the old Johnson house. She sent me a copy of the history of the West family, from the first West in America to Henry Lovejoy West, original source unknown, updated in 1921 by her grandmother, Lillian West Johnson. Henry Lovejoy West, born 1805, according to family history, gathered a group of volunteers during the Civil War. He drilled them, saw that they had uniforms, and joined a group of Pennsylvania volunteers. My research started out to prove this, but so far I can find no proof of his service. I have contacted the National Archives, New York, and Pennsylvania State Archives. My mother had a bullet, now the property of Richard Needland, that wounded him in the jaw in a battle in Beaufort, North Carolina. He was captured and was in Libby Prison, which I now believe was in or near Richmond, Virginia. His son-in-law, Josiah Stearns, worked the farm in Sparrowbush and was also a lock tender on the Delaware and Hudson Canal, which ran along the edge of the farm. My grandfather, Samuel Stearns, born 1849, was a boy during the Civil War. When he heard that there was fighting in Pennsylvania, he watched the hills across the Delaware from the farm, waiting to see a battle, not realizing that the fighting was in the southern part of the state. My grandfather had a sweet tooth and always used sugar in tea and coffee and on his cereal. When he was a boy, he was limited to one cup of molasses at a meal. My mother often wondered how much he would have used if he had not been limited. My grandfather was tall and slim. He had blonde, curly hair when he was young and blue eyes. Late in the afternoon of October 3rd, 1944, I walked up the street, Terrace Avenue in Rochelle Park, New Jersey, to the home of my mother and father. I was weary and uncomfortable. My third baby was overdue. My mother had a wire-haired terrier, Duchess, one of the quietest dogs I have ever known. That afternoon, she started jumping on me and whimpering and barking. After 15 minutes or so, when she wouldn't stop, I went home in disgust. My aunt, Sarah Stearns, was in the other room, and unbeknownst to me, said to my father, "See how Duchess is acting? She knows something. Ruth will have the baby tonight." I went into labor at about 11 p.m., and Ruth Ann was born at 1 a.m. on October 4th. Duchess lived several years longer, but never again acted like she had that day. Unquote.
With this introduction into the West-Stearns family, she then presents us with a family tree of the West family. Starts with Edward West, who was born in about 1700, moved from England to Long Island. And one of his sons, Nathaniel West, participated in the French and Indian War under Major Rogers. Now, on this family tree, it says that he died at Ticonderoga, January 1757. Although many people associate Ticonderoga with the Battle of the American Revolutionary War, since there was a fort there, I guess it would make sense that it was also a location of this battle during the French and Indian War. This battle was known as the Battle on Snowshoes, and it was a skirmish fought between Major Rogers' Rangers and French and Indian troops during the French and Indian War. It took place on January 21st, 1757, and it was given the name Battle on Snowshoes because the British participants in it, so I guess Nathaniel West, were wearing snowshoes during the battle because it snowed very heavily. The funny thing about, not about this battle, but just about the name Nathaniel West, is that there is a Nathaniel West who is an author who wrote Dave the Locust, all these great things. So I think it's very funny that I'm, I'm related to somebody named Nathaniel West. So I can just, I guess, pretend that I am related to one of my favorite authors. So in my great-grandmother's life writing work, in my own words, she writes about Johannes Quick, who is a Dutch ancestor of hers that came over in the 1620s. But I am unable to find any documents concerning him or the Quick family in the family history book that I have here, and in my own words, she also mentions Dudley Stearns. So the West family tree eventually winds up getting to the Stearns family. They married into the Stearns family about four generations after Nathaniel West participated in the French and Indian War. So that was when Marietta West married Josiah Stearns. So I guess I will now be reading a passage from In My Own Words about Johannes Quick and Dudley Stearns and their participation in the Revolutionary War in a pretty widely known battle. Again, it became pretty famous for reasons not involving them.
The following excerpt is from In My Own Words, and the chapter I'm reading from is 4th of July 2003. 4th of July 2003, a perfect day after many days of rain during the spring, warm with a gentle breeze. After breakfast and morning chores, I sat down to read the paper. About a quarter after 10 a.m., the phone rang. It was my grandson, Scott, a history buff. "Graham, turn on the History Channel. The Battle of Monmouth is on and the Revolution will be on for a 5-hour program." I had to lay down the paper and turn on the TV. After all, two of my ancestors were at the Battle of Monmouth. Johannes John Quick was part of my Jersey Dutch ancestry. His family had landed in New Amsterdam, later named New York, in the 1620s and settled, as many Dutch families did, in Ulster County on the western side of the Hudson. His family later moved to Sussex County, New Jersey. John could neither read nor write. His pension papers were signed with an X because there was no school in Sussex County when he was growing up. Dudley Stearns was the other ancestor who was at the Battle of Monmouth. He had served in the Massachusetts Continental Line, and when his enlistment ran out, he apparently was near New Jersey and enlisted in the New Jersey militia. John Quick was wounded at the battle. Dudley Stearns was doing guard duty over the baggage. It was a battle fought at a temperature of over 100 degrees Fahrenheit, and the men wore wool uniforms. Molly Stark kept bringing pitchers of water to her husband and many of the men. Thus the legend of Molly Pitcher was born. This is the battle where Molly Pitcher earned an everlasting fame by bringing pitchers of water from a well nearby to American soldiers. Did Dudley Stearns and John Quick meet at this battle? Is that why Dudley Stearns came back to New Jersey, met Elizabeth Osterhout, and fathered Albert Stearns, who later married John Quick's daughter, Elizabeth? If I were a novelist, I would write a book about them.
And now, finally, we get to the Tuthill family, which is the briefest part of this family tree to go through, since there's not too much on them. Most of what I have on the Tuthill family is written by my great-grandmother in the family history book, and doesn't have any documentation, at least within it, to back it up. So I'll just read what she wrote. Tuthill family, and I quote, "My grandmother, Jane Arminda Tuthill, was born and raised in Barryville, New York, a town on the Delaware River. Her father was a lumberman, as was his father before him. He floated logs down the Delaware to Philadelphia, then came home by train to New York City, and then to Barryville. Whenever we had nonpareils, flat chocolate candy with white dots, she always told us that her father brought some of these for the children each time he came home from a trip. My grandmother was the oldest of seven children and outlived them all. When she was 3 weeks old, company came to see the baby. Her mother reached into a barrel of corned meat to get a piece to cook for visitors. She apparently had a scratch on her arm, for she developed a severe infection from the Corning solution and was unable to nurse the baby. My grandmother often wondered how she was fed, with a bottle and a goose quill, or possibly with a sook. This is a piece of bread tied in a cloth and dipped in milk and given to the baby to suck on. However she was fed, it did not shorten her life, for she lived to be 80 years old. Her mother was listed as Helen in the 1850 census, apparently a nickname, because my mother was named for her and my mother was called Ellen. My grandmother, in turn, was named for her grandmother, Jane Rogers. All these years, until I saw the census, I thought her mother had died from the infection. My grandmother said she was descended from a Tuthill sent by the King of England to survey Long Island about 1623. In a topographical list of 2,885 English emigrants to New England between 1620 and 1650 by Charles Edward Banks, there's a Tuthill listed. His destination? Southold, Long Island. My grandmother told us that when Lincoln was assassinated, the word came over the telegraph wires. Quote, Lee has surrendered. Lincoln has been assassinated, unquote. She said it was done this way because people might riot if they heard about Lincoln first. Surrender of Lee was on April 9, 1865. The assassination of Lincoln on April 14, 1865. And that's where that ends. Now that I've gone through most of the stuff in the book that I find relevant, I like to just point out some things that are interesting or explain them, since this is a podcast and nobody can see if I decide to point at something. On the second to last page of this collection of documents, my great-grandmother has two pictures of a monument with the name Tom Quick on it. It says born 1734, died 1796. And I hate to say what's written on it because it's racist, but the monument says the Indian Slayer or the Avenger of the Delaware. So that's something I'm not exactly pleased with, and my great-grandmother doesn't really make any sort of commentary on that, which, I mean, I guess she was 99 years old in 2010, but still, she captioned it. In my write-up on the Quick family, I wrote about Tom Quick. Quote, there is a statue of him in the village square in Milford, Pennsylvania. I finally got to Milford, and what a surprise. The monument is actually his tombstone and located in the middle of a side street in a residential area. Unquote. So she doesn't have any critical remarks about that. So I've discovered by doing some quick research on Tom Quick that he's actually, I mean, not super, he's famous for being racist, I guess. But he was known as the Avenger of Delaware, the Indian Slayer. And there are a bunch of things on him online. And
online, it says he's alleged to have killed 99 people of the Munsee tribe, the Lenni Lenape, including women, infants, entire families. Never worried before that I would have an ancestor who was like a plantation owner or anything like that. And I never even considered I would have an ancestor who would do the things that Tom Quick apparently did. Tom Quick is related to Johannes Quick, who you might remember from the Battle of Monmouth before. So he's related to him. There was even a book written about him called Tom Quick, the Indian Slayer, published in 1851. What he did kind of became, nobody really knows what's true and what's not anymore, although we do know that he killed scores of people from the Munsee band of the Lenni Lenape. He was alleged to have killed 99 people, including women, infants, and whole families. This is supposedly as revenge for the brutal murders of his father and relatives. And it's noted on the page I'm looking at right now called WikiTree that the number of those killed may be exaggerated. Not, you know, obviously doesn't really help matters any. So this is something I didn't expect to find when I went through this. I just expected to find out the cool stuff about the Revolutionary War and, you know, find out what relative it was that fought in the American Revolution. And instead I stumbled upon this, which wasn't written about in my grandmother's life writing piece, and it wasn't really expanded upon in the family history book. I mean, the Quick family isn't really talked about much in there at all. I don't know if that's purposeful, because my great-grandmother still included the picture of the monument for him. It's all very confusing. And I don't know. It's confusing and it's complicated, and it's something that can't really be uncomplicated. You know, just because something is pressed into stone. I mean, he's been dead for however long at this point. Yeah, he died 1795. So even though he's been dead for over 200 years, what a mess he leaves behind. I don't know what to do with this information. I wish I knew what to do with it, but I don't. I really don't. So I expected to end the podcast on, you know, a nice reading of the original intro that I wrote for this, you know, making family history sound like a very flowery, beautiful thing. Or to read from my great-grandmother's book in my own words. And instead, I've discovered something that I'm not able to properly process, and I don't know what to do with it. I mean, it's that typical, you know, thing, white people, where there's some of us who feel guilty all the time, and then there's other ones of us who immediately say, no, well, that was my ancestors, I didn't do that. I currently feel strongly on the side of guilt after, you know, reading what he's done. Whether or not the numbers are exaggerated is irrelevant. For the legend of him to have become that big, in my mind there has to be something, some violence on his end to make any of that stand. So family history is complicated, as I'm quickly learning, and you can't change it. It just keeps on building and building and building. I don't know. I guess I'll read my grandmother's original reason for starting this family history mission. I'll read that, and that's all I can really do now. And this is titled Memories. What it started out to prove was the service of Samuel Bartholomew in the American Revolution. That became the start of my research, which I should have begun 20 years or more ago when I was younger. My mother had helped my sister Joan with a family tree that she did for a high school project. How lucky I was to be able to copy it, for it had the names and dates for several generations. And how pleased my mother would be to know that I've used it in my research. Little family stories, oft told, are the only accounts I have of Reverend Orlo Bartholomew and his wife, but none from earlier generations. One Sunday, driving to church in a wagon with two planks for the four sons to set on, one plank broke, and two boys landed on the floor of the wagon. Like children everywhere, they laughed. Their father, the minister, Orlo Bartholomew, turned and switched them with a horsewhip, because you don't laugh on Sunday. Another story is that two sons sat on the platform in back of their father when he was conducting services, and their mother sat in the congregation with a son on each side of her. Family history tells us that there were occasions when the two on the platform would get into fights when their father was preaching. In 1864, when my grandfather was 14 years old, his father died. This meant that the family could no longer live in the parsonage in Augusta. My great-grandmother bought a farm in Augusta for the sons to work, so there would be a way of making a living. The farm was mortgaged each time to send the three older sons to college. Two became lawyers and one a minister. My grandfather wanted to be a minister, but apparently the farm could not be mortgaged a fourth time. My grandfather did preach occasionally and was often asked to preach at funerals. He was a well-liked and highly respected individual. Sometime between 1915 and 1918, my grandfather visited us in Brooklyn on his way home from a church convention in Georgia. It seems that he was a delegate from a church in Augusta, and on the train going to the state church convention in Rochester, or was it Buffalo? And being an outgoing person, he talked to two other ministers, some from New York City, and he remarked, and he thought it a shame that no delegate from a small church in a small town was ever selected to go to the national convention. During the convention, one of the ministers he talked to nominated him, and he was elected to go to the national convention. My grandfather and grandmother raised four children. They lived to see each one of their children lose a child,
not tiny babies, but children ranging in age from 1 to 6.5 years. How difficult must have been for them not only to lose a grandchild, but to see their children grieving. My grandfather, Edward, and his wife were both heavyset people, and so were their 3 daughters and their son, my father. My grandmother's wedding dress, a 2-piece gray silk taffeta, was in the farmhouse when we visited. I remember her being this heavyset, but even when I was a slim girl, age 15 or 16, I could not close the waistband or button the top. My grandfather's eyes were very blue, and my grandmother's eyes were hazel. My father and 2 of my sisters had hazel eyes. After we got a car in 1923, we visited the farm about once a year. At the time, it was a 12-hour trip. What wonderful memories I have of those visits, driving the hay wagon, church suppers and square dances at the Grange. We referred to it as the homestead, but it did seem like a second home.
I'd like to thank several people for their help on this podcast. That help was indirect or direct. I'd like to thank my great-grandmother for compiling our family history, as well as her creating that life-writing piece that both have assisted me a lot in not only creating this podcast, but gleaning some sort of insight about our family history and her life. I'd also like to thank my Uncle Scott. He not only passed down this family history book to me and the, you know, life writing work, but he also nurtured a love for history in me, which eventually, you know, led to him passing these things down to me. So thank you for that. I'd also like to thank my parents for mailing me the binder and the autobiography before our house fire. Perfect timing, thank you. I'd also like to thank everybody in our life writing course, but especially Caitlin Flaws for letting me use her Blue Yeti microphone. It's very fancy, and I think this podcast would have been much worse without it and without her assistance. I'd like to thank Dr. Lee, of course, for everything that she's done in this course. I not only learned a lot from the books that we read, but also the discussions we had in class, and also the, you know, wide latitude that she provided for us, or allowed us, in terms of life writing project creation, or, you know, thought pieces. So I appreciate that. I'd also like to thank my friend Paul Weika, who has done nothing to contribute to this. He just asked to be included in this somehow. So now you are, Paul. Thank you. I think that's about it. So thank you. Hope you enjoyed the podcast. Maybe I'll create another one about something else.
Before I finish this entirely, in light of what I've discovered through this project, obviously I am talking about Tom Quick and his horrible actions and horrible place in history. And I decided to leave my first thoughts and first reactions to reading about him in there, because I thought to edit myself would be silly. But now that I've had time to reflect about it a little bit, I just like to say, even though it remains a complicated thing, that this it still kind of shows the purpose of history. It's not It's every time you look back, it's not going to be great. These are like, it's like the people that look back at the 50s and say the good old times without considering, you know, the racism and segregation that went along with it and everything else at that time. You know, you can't just look at everything with rose-tinted glasses. And that goes for looking at your own family history. And you're not only acknowledging that there were things wrong in the past, but by looking at that, you shouldn't just put that away and go, okay, that bad thing happened in the past. I should keep this with me. I should think about it as a way to be more mindful of other people, to do better in standing up for what's right. I'd like to think that I'm a progressive person, but I think I could still do more. And, you know, as with all things, that doesn't wipe out the injustices of the past. But you have to acknowledge all these things that have been wrong and continue to not be entirely fixed over time. You have to acknowledge that these problems are there, or at least that they once existed, in order to move forward as a individual, as a society, and all that. So yeah, I just wanted to get those final thoughts out on that, because that is something I've been thinking about a lot. I think my initial response, while inadequate, I decided to leave it in there anyway, because it was genuine, and it was what I was feeling at the time. And yeah, Tom Quick, you're an awful, you're the most despicable person I've heard of in a long, long time. I'm also upset that this was featured in my family history book through just a picture without an explanation of what he did and why it was wrong. There's no acknowledgement of what he did being an absolute horrible, not even act, because it's multiple acts. He massacred people. He massacred Native Americans. And I'm upset that wasn't acknowledged, but since this family history book is now in my possession, it will be put in there. I will print out necessary documents, and they will be put in that, because not everything in there should be good, should be exemplifying, you know, this wonderful history of participating in good causes like the Revolutionary War. You have to take the good with the bad, and with the downright despicable and awful, and acknowledge it. It has to be acknowledged. You can't just sweep things like that under the rug. So anyway, I just want to leave off with that. Thank you for listening. I know it's been a long listen, but thank you.